Forever Dog.
Comic books, comic time. Writers and artists are on the line. They make a splash as a comic's read and take us on a trip behind the spread. Watch out for comic book commentary. Spinning a winning inside fix, how they got a hot idea. Narrative, character, visual tricks, and bam, onomatopoeia. Uh-huh. It's comic book commentary.
All right. Welcome to comic book commentary. The episode on Skyward. My name is Joe Henderson. I am the co-creator of Skyward. Ben Blacker has been kind enough to invite me onto his podcast. How little does he know what a terrible, terrible job I'm going to do with it. But here we go. So I am going to be doing comic book commentary on Skyward number 10, which if you are listening to this, the minute it drops, it has just come out today. Whee! So I'm going to walk through the comic book page by page, panel by panel. If you're listening to a podcast about Skyward issue 10, chances are you're familiar with the book. So I don't need to do, I think, too much about pitching about what it is beyond the fact that it is a book about a low gravity reality where in, say, tomorrow, Earth lost a fraction of its gravity. This book takes place 20 years later where we've all adapted. Things are better, things are worse, but really just things are different because now you can fly through the air, but if you jump too high, you don't come back down. So that's the elevator pitch. I'm going to start going through. So page one, I wanted to do a nice slice of life piece of these farmers that we have met in arc two. I just like the idea of two of them sort of standing guard outside of a door and just getting a sense of the mundane commentary between them. So here we have our two guards and both of them talking about whether or not one of them wants to ask someone out on a date. Stan is named after my manager, Stan Spry. And so I was really excited to name someone who may or may not be having sex with bugs after my manager. I think he'll really enjoy that. Stan, I hope you're listening and I hope you are happy. But what I love about this in particular is that Lee chose it's a tricky composition because what I needed is two static characters and I wanted them just in the same position, but sort of floating up and down, the sense that there are two guards on display. But the difference is that because there's low gravity, instead of standing there, they're floating there. But also I wanted a bug to appear in the foreground as a visual gag of it's just a normal day. Oh, my God, giant bug, while also being able to see Willa in the final panel. So the tricky thing for Lee Garbett, who is our artist and co-creator, was finding the right angle that could let us see all that information that's a little dynamic and cool, but also still conveys sort of the mundanity of the concept. So I think he did a lovely job. And it is a very, very fun sequence. So that's page one. It's just sort of like our nice oddball, very mundane beginning to our very, very crazy issue. This is issue 10. It's the end of our second arc. So this is where everything comes to a head. We have a whole bunch of dynamics swirling around. The Willa needs to save the man who she blames for her father's death. Edison has found out that Willa is trying to bring gravity back. And since Edison has no legs from the knees down, he very much doesn't like that idea. And Barrow, meanwhile, has been lying in wait, whispering in people's ears, hoping that his manipulations will bear fruit. And this is the issue where they actually do. So that gets us through page one. On page two, we get the fun of these guys being distracted by the lightning bug, which we saw in a previous issue. And then we've got Willa and Edison running in. And one of the fun things was all of the research I did on what bugs eat what. And one of the very fascinating things I discovered is a lot of fireflies stop being carnivorous when they get older. So one of the fun things is you come up with a big crazy idea like, oh, hey, why don't I do a book about low gravity world? Well, what are the consequences of that? Well, one of the consequences, other than you floating through the air, is animals would adapt. Well, what would adapt faster? What would adapt in different ways? What kind of creatures would this be best for? And one of the things that I discovered very quickly was that it, one of the potential causes of the size bugs is gravity. So we took the next natural step on that and have, voila, giant bugs. But what's fascinating is the number of bugs who eat flesh. and the number ones that eat plants, and the number ones that switch. So turns out, hey, friendly bit of information, fireflies stop eating meat when they grow older. I think that can be a lesson for us all. So that was a bit of infotainment that made it for a fun little thing where Willa gets to meet this creature and then use it to create a distraction in our finale. So page two, panel four, here's Roger Barrow. He is our antagonist for the entire book. In the first book, the fight between her, Roger Barrow, and her dad resulted in her dad's death. This is the absolute last thing she wants to do. And one of the things I really wanted to do in this book is test Willa. Willa is this wonderful, light character. She's supposed to feel lighter than air because she's supposed to represent the world. And one of the things that this arc in particular wanted to do was drag her down and weigh her down and really challenge her. The first book was all about her being fearless. This second arc is all about her truly facing fear. And it felt like what greater thing to face than actually having to help the man who she blames for her father's death and deal with those emotions. So even though she's being a little light and even though she's being quippy about it, it's hiding her genuine uncomfortableness with what she's dealing with. Another interesting bit of infotainment, I guess, but on page one, when it's I'm just saying making you think about that is complete crap. One of the things I did is I changed the language in this book. Initially, I'd written a number of issues before it had even come out, and it was a lot more blue. And I started to find that younger readers had really responded to it. So one of the things that I did verbally and Lee and Antonio did color-wise is make it a bit more safe for younger readers. My 3.5-year-old reads this book and loves it. And I keep that in mind, even though this is wildly un-age appropriate for him. We don't have excessive blood. I've really pulled back on any swear words. There used to be a lot more swearing in the book, and I kind of like that it doesn't need that, that it can be a safer book that still deals with weightier issues, but that at least on its surface isn't a offensive to younger readers, because I do think that it's a fun book for younger readers to discover and enjoy. On to page three. So here we've got Roger Barrow with Willa, and here we can see Barrow sort of digging at the fission that he's created between Willa and Edison, sort of hinting at, what was your plan, Willa? Her saying, all I want to do is stop the war. And Willa's not lying, in as much as that that is all she wants to do right now. But what Barrow was really doing is nudging Edison and saying, we both know that she has a greater plan beyond this. And I want to remind you that whose side you're really on. Do you want to work with the girl that you have a crush on, or do you want to save your ability to walk? So, and we can see Edison struggling with that in the third panel until they are interrupted on panel four by Serena. So that brings us to page, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, where we get to understand Serena. We get to have a sense of where she stands and Willa trying to connect with her. This seems really important to me because I want to get inside Willa's head a little bit. So much of this issue is about arcing her character and understand and processing what she's gone through. In issue 6, her dad has died and she both blames herself, but also feels this incredible burden on herself to take his mission and carry it with her. And here you have another woman whose brother died. This is Willa trying to confront that. Like, you want this death to mean something. You need it to. She's trying to connect with her, but Serena's not listening. This is not a message Serena's going to listen to because Serena doesn't have the same hope in her heart that Willa does. So what you see is Willa's empathic attempt to connect to Serena. And then what you get is the B-side, which is Barrow's fear-based attack. So that takes us on to page 6. If I've got these numbers right, where Barrow then does his side, which is emotional devastation. This is Barrow, the businessman. He's a terrible human being. He's awful and evil, and this is what he does. He knows how to crush an enemy, and what he sees is someone vulnerable, and he pushes exactly where it hurts. So this is a woman who's dealing with guilt, who wants it all to mean something. Will is trying to prove to her that it'll matter. Barrow is trying to push on the wound. So, all right, that's one, two, gotta get page numbers on these, three, four, five. So when Barrow finally leaves, that is him basically saying, hey, that was easy. That was child's play. This is what I can do. You finally unleashed a monster and the monster is on your side. And so that's the other thing I kind of want to play with is Willa knows to protect Chicago. She has to unleash a monster. And this is the first example of the consequences of that, which is, dear Lord, the very first act he does is crush a woman. And that's both terrifying to her, but also the what she hopes is the greater good, the necessary thing she needs to do. On to the next page. So this is Barrow's trying to take control. He's trying to lead because that's what he always do. He always leads. He's always in charge. But Willa and Edison have a plan. And one of the things I really wanted to create is a really a smart plan that would work if not for complications. So here we have is they're basically and a fun plan. One of the things I wanted to do is this is the issue where we're leaving the farm. We're going to be going away from it. So what are the aspects of the farm that we haven't seen? Whenever you introduce a toy like this, you want to play with every aspect of it. So that's why I wanted to do the fighting room where you see that they've got mock bugs where they're learning to fight, how they sleep in this place. The Firefly room, I wanted to when Lucas and Willa had dinner in a previous issue, I wanted to see what a romantic dinner looks like, both in low gravity and out on this farm. And so here, so much of what we've built into this mythology is that everyone's eating bugs. So I felt like I owed it to the readers, but also the fun of the read to figure out how to show what the butchering looks like. And by saying I had to figure it out, I mean Lee had to figure it out. And one of the exciting things about working on Skyward is working with someone as talented as Lee, because every single issue I try to include some new aspect of world building, which is exciting and awesome for a reader and for a writer, but a lot of work for an artist because he has to create all new things out of whole cloth. And, you know, I mean, with this arc, you've got the farm. So once he figures out what that looks like, he's got a bit of it. He's got a language for it, but you know, you go to the farm and then hey, here's the butchering area. What does butchering area look like? What does a butchered bug look like? What do the people who butcher them look like? There's a lot of work that goes into these world building books, whereas I can just write. Let's see what I wrote on this page. So on page 6, panel 2, they move towards a meat processing area. We may notice a bug carcass in the distance ready for processing. That's all I wrote. And what Lee had to then draw is a meat processing area, which, you know, that's a single sentence for me. And that's a lot of research and figuring out for Lee. And I think he did a lovely job of making it feel very grounded and very normal and also very gross, but not too graphic. So when on panel 4, Willa shoves Barrow in, it's gross and it's pink. And again, this is Antonio Fabella, our colorist. It's graphic without being too graphic. It's playful graphic because it's sort of got this pink, gross color, which just sort of makes you makes me at least sort of cringe. But also it there's a little bit of fun to it. You know, that's always the fun of this world is the mixture of danger, horror, adventure, and thrill. And so to me, it's like, yeah, climbing into a giant bug and trying to smuggle yourself through that sounds both disgusting and kind of awesome. That gets us through page 6 where, Barrow desperately does not want to go along with his plan. Willa herself doesn't even want to go along with his plan, but this is the plan and that's what they have to do until of course on page 7, here is our interruption. The plan would have gone great if not for those, pesky kids or if not for the super handsome, Lucas Serrano. So Lucas enters, he becomes the spanner in the works. One of the things I really wanted to do in this arc is play with a bit of a love triangle. In the first arc, Edison is very clearly the love interest. He's handsome. He's cool. He's actually the damsel in distress at the end of the arc, which I thought was a fun subversion of what we normally see. And so in this issue, I wanted to keep a bit of tension between him and Willa, both in the fact that she's keeping a secret from him, but also in the idea that here is someone who represents a worldview that could parallel Willa's. This is someone who's been hurt a lot by the world. Edison's been helped by the world. Edison's family is rich. He can fly through the air now, whereas before the world, he would have been in a wheelchair or with metal legs. So Edison represents the best of the world, and Lucas seems to represent the good of the world. But as we unpeel the onion of the character, we start to realize that he represents the worst of it, both what he's gone through and the way he's processed it. Because ultimately, he's a little crazy, and he's a little crazy because he's a survivor. He's had to survive in terrible situations. He's had to fight bugs to stay alive. And so a really big part of it is Lucas thinking in Willa, he's found a kindred spirit, someone who understands him, someone who's fought back against the city, someone who's lost so much. Meanwhile, looking at Edison and not quite understanding him, because here's this rich boy who seems to be along for the ride, but why? And so both, why is he doing this? And also, is he a threat romantically? Because Lucas is very much interested in Edison. So our plan was going great. Lucas comes and screws it up. I absolutely love panel 4 of page 7, which is Willa peeking out from the carcass. It's not an easy thing to draw because you have to draw a very small face and a facial expression, but Lee is very good. And for one thing, Lee is just amazing at character work in general. That's why I think the book works, is because you have big crazy ideas, but the characters feel real. And little moments like this, where you don't have much to work with, he's able to still make you feel Willa's emotions, even from such a distance. And yeah, he's pretty good. I'm gonna try to hold on to him. So page 8. A little time has passed. The guys are coming in to cut open the bug. I really wanted to. The challenge of this book is there's some really dark stuff, and you always want to try to find the humor. You want to try to find the fun. I mean, Willa is literally on an adventure with the dude who she blames for her dad's death. Lucas is, in theory, accidentally slaughtered millions of people. So finding the ways to have fun with this world is so important, because even though really dark stuff happens and even though really sad things happen, there's got to be a light within the dark. That's, to me, that's what makes it relatable. That's what makes it human, because we joke our way through the worst of situations as well. So in this case, I think Willa is just being very clever and figuring out a way to explain why she's inside the middle of a bug's stomach, which is by just pretending that they got eaten by the bug and that these people are their heroes. And I also love the fact that the guy, that one of the techs just vomits upon seeing them, because what a horrifying, terrifying sight. I also learned how to write vomit sound effects in this one. I did not know how to write Lee gave me a couple suggestions, and I actually don't know if the final version is what we did or what Simon Boland, our letterer, did. By the way, a good letterer is your greatest friend, and we have Simon Boland in our book, who is an amazing letterer, who understands the pacing of a book. Like, I take for granted how easy it is to get this book done, partially because Simon does the word balloons in such a way to match the rhythm of the writing. And that's its own art. That's its own sense of editing. And having a good letterer who can do that is worth their weight in gold. So their plan has changed. They're trying to audible. And we're getting the banter where Willa is trying to show confidence in front of Barrow. Barrow is showing scorn and skepticism about everything she's doing. That takes us up to page 9. One other thing to mention, as I'm going through this, is the first arc was very, very wide open and very few panels. I wanted it to feel like the world, low gravity, open, free. And the second book, for one, I wanted to cram even more story into it. But two, I wanted to feel more claustrophobic, because in the second book, Willa doesn't feel the same way. She doesn't have the same sense of the world being bright and shiny. And so we increased the number of panels. We increased a little bit of the sense of claustrophobia. I still wanted the sense of wonder, but you'll notice that there's a little bit more going on per page, and part of that is to reflect Willa's journey. So page 9, Edison and Lucas enter the greenhouse. This is your typical bro code conversation within the world of low gravity. And again, more world building. I wanted to see what a greenhouse looked like. Like tomato plants. Tomato plants grow up. So what a fun, cool idea to see them growing as high as possibly can be. Just, you know, giant rows of them. So again, like within a very normal conversation between two dudes, I wanted to get an element of world building in as well. But I also really liked, once I realized, oh, I want to do a greenhouse, I can do tomatoes. I also realized, oh, greenhouses have glass. We haven't really played with what shattered glass would do in low gravity. So sometimes you back yourself into a cool idea. I started with tomatoes. I started with, well, what are things that grow up? We're on a farm. We've seen the butchering of the animals. What about the plants? Well, if we go to a greenhouse, all of a sudden you both get a cool visual, but you get a sense of danger. You get a sense of threat that you weren't even expecting. So it's sort of walking down a path and finding the nice, surprising gifts that come along with it. So Edison's playing a little coy here. He's trying to play it all off. She saved my life. I owe her. That's not all the truth. He definitely has feelings for her, mixed with guilt, mixed with frustration. She did save his life and he does owe her, but there's much more than that. He cares about her. But he's not going to tell this guy this because he's not going to let him in. Meanwhile, Lucas isn't as afraid to let Edison in to a certain point. He's the warrior. He's going to put it all on the table. That's how he approaches things. So as you get to page 10, he's just basically saying, hey, you know, like, I don't know what to do with you. I do like her and I'm just trying to process these things. He feels like he's got everything in control. He's in the power position. And at the end of the page, we learn why, which is because he's actually gotten what he needs from Barrow. So this is the guy who already won and is sort of taking a victory lap and figuring out what else he can get. That's the other thing I wanted to sort of play with is this is our penultimate issue. And I feel like this is our final issue of the arc. And so one of the things you really want to do is you both want to have everything explode against each other, but also in a different way from the first arc. So in the first arc, Edison gets kidnapped and Willa has to save him after saving her dad. In this one, I wanted it to feel very different. So I started off exploring it more as a jailbreak. And so, okay, what are the fun ways to do a jailbreak and what are the things we want to see? Well, I want to see her and Barrow working together because that's the worst place she could possibly be. That's the last place Willa wants to be. I want to see Edison versus Lucas because I want to see the two guys vying for Willa's heart up against each other. But I also want to see Willa come in and take control within it. And then I also wanted to culminate the lie or the secret that Willa has been keeping from Edison this whole time in the worst possible way, because this is our second arc and I want something juicy to lead us into our third arc. So taking us to page 11, I want to play with the idea that Willa is a bit of a folk hero. I think there's something really cool about the idea that this thing that she did in the first arc that didn't mean anything to her beyond saving her dad has become a symbol to a lot of other people, which when I wrote the first arc was not intentional. I didn't realize how much I'd really get out of her actions in Chicago. And as I kept writing, I realized, oh, this is a Katniss Everdeen. And I did not ever want to make Willa a Katniss Everdeen figure because I felt like that's not something that she would gravitate towards. But weirdly, the story kept pulling her towards it. And I like that. I like the fact that she's not trying to go there, but that the story and her actions take her there. Her bravery takes her there. And so that was more the story telling me how the world would react to her than me creating the story that that would get us there. And so the thought then came, well, if these people are going to be fans, what about a young girl who looks up to Willa as maybe like 6 months younger than her? And here's someone who represents what she could be. And Willa, unfortunately, having to, you know, use that against her for the greater good. And then, of course, and basically use the speak to her own pain and say, what you think I'm helping the guy who killed my dad escape on page 11, like really saying like, come on, how absurd is this concept? Because I would never do that. And really just putting on its feet the terrible situation she's in. This is the last thing she wants to do. And then at the end of the page, when he says, I didn't kill him, you did. It was important for me in two things. One, to have Barrow voice that idea. And two, on page 12, to have Willa call him on his BS, because I think what's nice is this is issue 10. This is the end of her second arc. Her arc has all been about facing her fears and asking the question of who she is. And what I find very touching about this is she has realized that blaming Barrow for her father's death takes away her father's sacrifice. Because Barrow didn't kill her dad. Her dad sacrificed himself. And there's a very, very important difference between those two things. And she's been blaming Barrow for her father's death and giving sort of the sacrifice back to her dad in this issue, I think was just a really important part of her growth. It's all about ownership. It's all about personal responsibility. And this is the issue where she voices the lesson she's learned, which is, I have to be responsible for my actions. My dad was responsible for his actions. And you, Barrow, you are responsible for your actions. And don't you dare take credit for anything else. And don't you dare take credit for anything. The incredible sacrifice my dad made. So that was a very important scene to me, because I feel like within all the craziness and big, awesome ideas, it's all about heart. Like, this book for me is all about heart. It's all about Willa. It's all about the journey she goes on and the lessons she's learning. And to me, this is where she faces her fear and realizes what her dad's sacrifice really meant. He didn't do it. She can't blame herself for what he did. She can honor what he did. Going into page 13. So Lucas has realized their whole plan has gone pear-shaped, and the only way to stop Lucas is to attack Lucas. The problem is Lucas has pretty much figured out that Edison is up to something. So he's ready for it, has been ready for it this entire time. And this is really cool because one of the things that actually I learned from a friend of mine, Jason Ning, who worked on The Expanse season one, is The Expanse did a lot of research into zero gravity and zero gravity fighting. And one of the things that you would have happen is your fighting styles would change. And this was something that I dug into a bit in the first arc. When it comes to guns versus knives and things like this. But he also mentioned martial arts. And one thing in particular is the different martial arts. And jiu-jitsu is much more based on body pressure and holds and throws and things like that, that in low gravity would be how you fight, because it's all about directionality and where you're throwing someone. And so what I loved is getting to this point where you've got this rich kid versus the farm boy, and the farm boy underestimates him because he's just some rich kid. But the fact of the matter is he's learned jiu-jitsu, which is all that matters is how you hold people, how you grab people and how you throw them, which is something he can do with or without legs. Having said that, getting onto page 14, I couldn't help but make a joke about the legs from Lucas's perspective, which is a really low blow. And also I completely stole from Brian K. Vaughan's run on Ultimate X-Men of all things, because there's a sequence where I think it's Mr. Sinister throws Professor X down the stairs and makes a joke about, I have one thing you don't, legs. It's almost word for word homage or ripping off, whatever you want to call it. But it felt appropriate here, and hopefully I did it in a slightly different way. But I am completely stealing from the best in that case. So that brings us to page 14, where we get to play with shards of glass. And again, like, this is low gravity. These things are floating in the air. They're all around them. There's something cool and exciting about just as something as simple as a greenhouse suddenly turned into a weapon. And then this is our opportunity to see Lucas versus Edison, both for the heart of Willa, but also for their own agendas coming to a head and then being interrupted by the same thing that Willa saw a couple pages ago, which brings us to page 15. The farm is burning. And so that is the image from our cover. This is this gorgeous image that that both Lee on the cover and Antonio here brought to this just vibrant, dark, very, very rich life. And again, I wrote, full page spread, the farm is burning. Embrace in any way you can how fire and smoke look in low G and give it a surreal world, weird look, which I think both on the cover and here, Lee and Antonio did very well, because fire moves very beautifully and very strangely in low gravity. There's actually these really cool videos of the space station online that I used. At times, fire can look like a jellyfish. It can like almost look like it's alive. And these are things that you can't really convey on a comic book page, but selling the sort of strangeness of it, like, you know, fire, but this both looks like fire, but looks like something different. And walking that fine line is a very tricky line that they walked very well. On to page 16. So here's Edison and Lucas, and this is where Edison realizes just how far Lucas is willing to go, and just what the exact plan is, which Lucas has decided there's only one way to get out of here. There's only one way to win, and that's he needs his farmers behind him, but he also needs his farmers to have no other choice. This is a war. There is no way to win, but to be as ruthless as possible and to back themselves into a corner. And I think one of the things Edison's speaking to here is even my family wouldn't do something like this. Like, Edison sees his family as the worst of the worst, but now he's actually seeing something even worse. And this will actually play into our third arc, where we will actually, spoilers, meet Edison's family. And I'm really trying to sort of tease them out and give context to who they are, which is they are not very good people, but they are not this bad of people. And so hopefully give a sense of excitement about meeting who these people are and deciding for ourselves just how bad they are. I did not write Lucas creating glass Wolverine claws like he does on panel 4, and I love it. And again, like I wrote, Lucas starts to lose it, advancing towards them with blades of glass in his hands. And Lee was like, well, if he's holding the glass, he might be cutting his hands. What if he puts it between his fingers? It'll also look awesome. So again, this is the fun of collaborating with someone who is so imaginative and can also come up with cool, iconic looks. Like, this is, I think he called out, it's the gray with Liam Neeson. It's like you've got these shards of glass, you hold them between your fingers, and you both look awesome, and it's a little more functional than holding a piece of glass that's probably cutting you more than it is anyone else. And then bringing us to page 18, Willa with her big, beautiful wings, culmination of her character, learning how to adapt to this world. Here she is wearing wings that we saw her struggling with before. She's got it under control. She's adapted to this world. She's in charge. She has gone from caterpillar to butterfly. The metaphor is not on the nose at all, I swear. And really just stepping up and taking ownership of this world. And she understands who Lucas is now. She understands who she is now. She understands what she needs to do. And she's trying to reason with Lucas. She's trying to have him understand. But she just, there's no reasoning with this man. Lucas is too far gone. And so she throws glass at him, because that's what you do when it looks really, really cool, and it's a cool moment. this is interesting. So on to page 19, I had to add a bit of dialogue because I realized, and this is something that happens, this is the beauty of comics to me, is the rewrite, which is there you have this awesome panel on page 18 where she's shooting glass at Lucas, and I got to the next page, I'm like, oh, I don't know if he's alive or not, and that's on me. He got it exactly how I wrote it, page 17 to page 18, because like I wrote glass shards go flying at Lucas. Lucas yells, ah, and then on page 18, I'd originally just written that they're already talking about the next stuff. The first line is, we need to get the transport before it leaves. And in reading it, you're like, oh, is Lucas dead? Is he alive? And so I added some dialogue that says that should hold Lucas off for a bit to bridge the gap. And that's one of the things that as a newer comic writer, I'm still learning, is the things that the visuals won't always sell that you're just assuming will be part of the DNA. And it's the same thing as working in TV when you get into editing and you're suddenly like, oh, I need this piece. I didn't even think I needed this piece because I felt like it would be conveyed visually, but it's not being conveyed visually at all. And that's very rarely the fault of the director or the artist. It's usually a lack of imagination on us writers. So, or the artist has chosen a different way to convey something that conveys one part even better, and then you just need to speak to it in a different way. But in this case, this was all on me. But again, the fun is you get the pages and you're like, okay, how do I very quickly bridge these moments? And so that should hold Lucas off for a bit. So we're like, oh, wow. Okay. So moving on to the next. Now we have our cool page 18 rushing through the burning farm. And I wanted to really show that Willa had gotten used to the wings, but I also wanted to now collide the Edison Willa stories. Now that Lucas is sort of taken care of, at least for a little bit, now it's time for the most important story, the story between Willa and Edison, which to me is really the true crux of the second arc, which is the secret she's been keeping from him. And the fact that he finds out in the worst possible way because Barrow uses it to weaponize Edison against them. So here Edison has done the math. He's realized that he's made a terrible mistake. He's not telling her yet because he's hoping he can fix it before she needs to know. They get to the transport. We see the father and the child one last time. The father, by the way, is based visually on the actor from iZombie. I do not know his name, but I know that Lee based him on him, and very handsomely, I would say. So they get there. They're too late. That brings us to page 19. By the way, perfect example, panel one. Like Lee does such a great job of putting action into a single panel. Like Willa taking off the wings is a difficult visual. And not only does he make it read visually, but he makes it look really cool. I'm always in awe of how artists can take really tricky moments that are almost moments between moments, moments of action where you have to both imply action, but also have it read. And that panel in particular really impressed me because I'm like, okay, that's, you're tracking so much, but also she just looks really cool. And so this is where on page 19, everything comes to a head, where Edison has to admit the truth, both that he knows what Willa's been doing and that he's acted against it. And what was really important to me in this sequence is that Willa and Edison are both at fault. Willa is at fault because she lied to Edison. She has the original sin, but she had a passive sin. Edison has an active sin, which is he gave Barrow her dad's book. And so she has the first one. It was passive. He has the second one. It was active. In theory, they balance out, or at least they're both responsible. And one of the things I didn't want to do is have this big scene where they yell at each other and then they go off in their own directions. These two characters are actually more mature than they were at the beginning of the story. They're more mature than they were at the in the first issue when Edison misinterpreted her talking about his lack of legs and she was super embarrassed. Instead, they've grown up and they've both realized they've both screwed up. And so going on to page 20, where she says, no, not yet. I can beat him to Kansas City and I'll go with you. And then she refuses him. He thinks that they're still back where they were. And she's like, no, she gets it. She made mistakes. He made mistakes. We just need to fix this. And then when she says, I should have told you everything from the beginning, it's her saying, I'm sorry. He says, I would have tried to stop you. It's him saying, I'm sorry. These are two people who have gone through incredible things together. They both screwed up. They're both realizing it. And it's too late to do anything about it other than try to move forward. So I wanted to find something healthier and stronger that spoke to the characters and the strength of the characters and the journeys they've been on. They have made mistakes, but they can also learn from them. And I just love the idea of Edison having to ride a bug because that is the thing that has terrified him for most of this arc. And I just love characters riding bugs because that's amazing. On to page 21. I love this Lucas design for the armor. Actually, we went back and forth a lot about what the color of the armor would be, and Lee settled on this awesome goldish yellow, like yellow jackety sort of thing, which just both speaks to war, but also the different kinds of bugs out there. It feels cool and weird, but still within the language of our world. Again, and you got the face, so you've got the B side of the A side of all the glass being thrown at him. He's all screwed up now. If anything, he's more mad and determined than ever because of what happened with him with Willa. We have a visual representation of what he's gone through and what she's done to him. But we also now understand how he got slowed down. So this is my sort of Empire Strikes Back moment. If the first one was Star Wars and the third arc is our Return of the Jedi moment, this is the moment where everything is darkest before the dawn. And I wanted to go both darkest before the dawn, but similar to Empire, do with hope. You've got an army headed to Chicago. The one way to save it is a book that Barrow is running away with. So my own worst enemy has the one fix that I need. And what do I do? And I love that so much of this arc has been Willa being down and then this being about her picking herself back up. So her argument is basically, sure, Barrow is ahead of us, but we have each other. Like, I don't just have myself. I'm used to being on my own, so I could do fine on my own, but I don't even need to do that because of what I've learned. My arc has brought me to this moment and I have picked up from it. And so I really just wanted to bring her character to a stronger moment. The hero has been tested and has failed at times, but has ultimately come back stronger and she has faced her fear. The first arc, she's the fearless girl. The second arc, she's the fearful girl. Now she's ready to face even greater things, but is more formidable than ever. So that brings us to our last page, which is when she's doing her Hulk jumps, which I've been really excited to do, is this terrifying idea of you go through the desert, you make one wrong jump, and you could never come back down. But she's brave and ready, and she can do this. And so she's Hulk jumping her way to Kansas City. And then one of the things that was really exciting about this book is this is where I had plotted it to end, which is her jumping forward and us being like, great, can't wait to see the next book. And it didn't feel like enough. It didn't quite feel like enough. And then I just started brainstorming, well, what if there's a mysterious figure looking at them? And I like to sometimes write myself into corners of a simple gimmick. Like, we've seen that gimmick 1,000 times, but what's the personal version of it? So I started playing with it. Okay, you've got a simple idea of a mysterious figure. And then the question sort of became, well, who could it be? And that's the big mystery that will actually be revealed in the next issue. And, you know, the person says, my sweet baby girl, I'm coming for you. There's only so many options for who that could be. But I will leave that to you, dear reader. Only know that the decision on the identity of that person was not made lightly, and that the amount of story that we are going to get out of it in the third arc, story that I didn't even anticipate being able to explore until I backed myself into this sort of concept-y corner, makes me wonder how I could have written the third arc ever without it. So that is it for my comic book commentary. Again, Lee Garbett, co-creator and artist. He's amazing. I love him. Antonio brings it all to vibrant life. Simon makes my words look good. Rick Lopez Jr. is the unsung hero of our team. A good editor is worth his weight in gold. I think I said that about Simon. They're both worth their weight in gold or platinum even. They're awesome. But Rick makes sure that I don't have terrible typos and that the story actually makes sense. So thank you to the incredible team. Thank you for listening. Please pick up Skyward. Issue 10 is on shelves right now. The first trade is available at your local bookstore or Amazon. The second trade should be available in the next couple weeks. It's called Here There Be Dragonflies. The third arc starts, I think, about a month and a half after this drops. Issue 11. Issue 1 of the arc is called Fix the World. It is our biggest, craziest arc yet. It pays off all of the questions you've been asking for, answers for, and it is awesome. So, thank you.
Forever Dog.
This has been a Forever Dog production. Executive produced by Brett Boehm, Joe Cilio, and Alex Ramsey. For more original podcasts, please visit foreverdogpodcasts.com and subscribe to our shows on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Keep up with the latest Forever Dog news by following us on Twitter and Instagram @ForeverDogTeam and liking our page on Facebook.